That's text 21 of the book? Upikiyamano lalitam Upikiyamano lalitam Upikiyamano lalitam Sri Janai Badha Sohidai Sri Janai Badha Sohidai Sri Banai, Sri Janai, Bada Sohridai, Upagiyamano Lalitam, Sri Janai, Bada Sohridai, Su Alankritan, what's a big word? Alankritano Liptango. Alankritanu liptango.
Alankritanu liptango.
Su alankrita anulipta ango. Three words, four words. Su alankritanu liptango.
Su alankritanu liptango.
Su alankritanu liptango. Bit of a tongue twister, isn't it? Sagvino Virajo Ambaro Sagvino Virajam Virajambaro Sagvino Virajambaro Sualankritanu Liptango Sragvino virajambaro Upagiyamano laditam Sri Janai Varasohidai Svalankritanu liptango Sragvino virajambaro Upagiyamano lalitam. The glory is being sung. Lalitam. Charmingly. Sri Janai. By the women folk. Badha. Bound. Sohridai. In affection for them. And them's got a capital T, so you know it's talking about Krishna and Balaram. Su alankrita, finely decorated, anulipta, and anointed with sandalwood pulp. Ango, whose limbs? Shrakvino, wearing flower garlands. Viraja, spotless. Ambaro, whose garments? So a very nice description here of Krishna and Balaram. And whoever was attending yesterday's class will know that we've just started a new pastime. The first verse, or the previous verse, was just talking about, well, the previous section, I was just talking about Shankarachuda, how he tried to steal. Oh, no, sorry, this is coming into Shankarachuda. The previous one was when Nanda Maharaj was. Vidyadhara that was disguised as, or who was embodied as a serpent, tried to swallow Nanda Maharaj, and you know the cowherd men tried to beat him off with flaming torches, and no effect. And then Krishna just came and touched him, touched the serpent with his lotus feet, and immediately he took on his Vidyadhara form and told the story about how he was Sankarshan, and he was cursed by some associates, I think it was associates of Angira Muni, to take that form as a snake. Because actually, that's right. He was, because oftentimes we find with the Muni, it's just like if you anyone who's heard the Mahabharata or read the story in the Mahabharata, when Vichitravirya and Chitaratha, who were the brothers? No, they were the children of Shantanu and Satyavati. Yeah? So they, Chitaratha was killed in a fight with a Gandharva who had the same name, and Vichitravirya he died of tuberculosis. Actually, it's said by someone he died of indulgence. And so then they, because he had three wives, two wives actually, because Ambika went back to, she didn't want to marry Vichitravirya, but anyhow, he had two wives, and because they had no husband and there was no heir to the throne, then they arranged for Vyasadeva to impregnate these two ladies. And when the first, I don't remember which one's first or second, when the first one was, the older girl was meant to meet Vyasadeva, she was so frightened by his homely appearance, to use a polite word, that she closed her eyes during conception. So therefore the first child, Dhritarashtra, was born blind. And then when the second girl was due to mate with Vyasadeva, she was so scared of his appearance that she went white. So then the second child was born, was called Pandu. And Pandu means the white one. And he was born white, because she was just mortified. So in the same way, like sages, we actually see sages are generally speaking, they're not so concerned with their bodily appearance, because they're absorbed in their bhajan, they're absorbed in chanting the glories of Krishna, etc. like that. So Angira Muni and his associates, these sages, they're called the Angira Rasas, they were the associates of Angira Muni. They were quite plain in their appearance, quite homely, often they have dreadlocks and their skin's quite leathery because they don't take such good care of it. Like they keep clean and everything, yet they don't take such good care of it. And when you're living out in the forest, anyone who's spent time even living in somewhere like Vrindavan, you'll know that your feet get very calloused, etc. like that, because it's a harsh environment. So also when you live in the forest, it's a harsh environment, so the skin becomes quite tough. They had this very homely appearance. So this Vidyadhara, Sankarshan, he laughed at them. He thought it was quite, because he was proud of his, because Vidyadharas are very, very beautiful. You find that most of the denizens of the heavenly planets, the Gandharas, the Vidyadharas, the Chanaras, etc., they're very beautiful in their bodily form. And actually it's interesting because people here on this planet, when they see some, like model or movie star or whatever, like male or female, they consider them to be very, very beautiful. But actually, in relation to the demigods, in relation to the persons on these higher planets, their appearance is very ordinary. And actually, the demigods, they don't come here because, one of the reasons they don't come here is because they stink too much. And the people on this planet have a very, very strong bodily odor. Whereas you see, for instance, there's a description in the, I believe it's the fifth canto, where it describes the Ilavritta Varsh and all the different Varshas that are there in the greater cosmic, what would you call it? Just the greater, not what we see here, this little planet we see, but actually there's a greater description, like a higher understanding of the way the universe is laid out. And actually it's described that it's actually like a giant plateau, and there's like these rings of mountains. I think there's seven rings of mountains from memory. And anyway, one part of that is called Ilavritta Varsh, and there's a mountain there. And on top of this mountain there grows a gigantic mango tree. I think it's 800 miles high or something like that. Gigantic mango tree.
800,000,
okay. It's 800 something. It's a big mango tree. Anyhow, there's mangoes, they drop from this mountain, and they're as big as elephants, and they're tiny, tiny little seeds. And then the mangoes, when they drop, they're super ripe. Yeah? So what happens is when they drop, they hit the ground, and they just turn into mango juice. And they become rivers. And because of the effect of this, these rivers, then gold is produced from the rivers, and you know, you can just pick up lumps of gold on the bank. And the residents of heavenly planets, the devas, they take bath in these rivers, and their body takes on a most wonderful aroma. So you know, when they smell the people down here, it's not very pleasing to them. So you know, it's good to understand these things so we can keep in perspective the reality of our situation. That even though we may have a very, very handsome body, it's a relative thing. Because, you know, for others, it is not very handsome. For the residents of the heavenly planets, it's not a very handsome body. And then, you know, we can look at other species of life. And Lord Kapiladeva, he talks about this in the third canto. And there's a very interesting verse there where he talks about how the living entity, he finds a particular satisfaction no matter what species of life he appears in. He is never averse to being situated in such a form. And in the purport there, Srila Prabhupada talks about the story about when Lord Indra becomes a pig. So you've probably all heard this story, but basically what happens is Lord Indra, because of his greedy mentality, and he actually tried to forcefully have sex with the wife of his spiritual master, Brihaspati. And so Brihaspati cursed him to become a pig. And so he was sent down to the earthly realm to become a pig. And then of course, because in the heavens there was no ruler, things started to go awry. You know, the things started to go wrong. So the demigods, they went and said to Lord Brahma, that please you bring Lord Indra back, because things just aren't going well. So he went down to see Lord Indra in his pig body. And he said, come back to the heavenly planets, come back and you know, take back your job. He said, heavenly planets? What do you mean? He said, you're the king of heaven, come back to the heavenly planets with me. He's going like this. And like, you know, I mean, this Indra in the pig's body couldn't actually conceive of what he was talking about. And he's trying to explain the opulence of the heavenly planets. And he's saying, but you know, how can I leave my wife and family? I mean, look at my wife, she's so beautiful. You know, so he's describing that his pig wife is very beautiful. But for us, when we look at something like a pig, who considers that beautiful? Of course, when you see the little, in Vrindavan, you see the little tiny piglets like this, you know, you get them with little stripes and stuff, they're kind of cute, you know, and just running around the place squealing and things like that. But then when you look at the, you know, the large pig, the sow, you know, she's got, how many have they, 10 or 12 udders or whatever they have, 10 or 12 teats or something like that, they have quite a few, you know. Now, for someone in a human form of life, this is not a particularly attractive form. But for someone who's a pig, very attractive. We look at something like a slug. You know? Creepy, crawly things, you know, or centipedes or spiders. And my wife's terrified of spiders. We get these spiders in Mayapur. They're kind of like a huntsman, but they get up to about this big. You know, they're not, I don't know if they're aggressive or not, but they do run at you. I had one run at me a time before last time. It's a bit scary. But anyhow, they're like, for us, you know, particularly for my wife, they're very ugly things. Huh? But for the spider's partner, they happen to be very attractive. So the thing is, beauty in this world is a relative thing. Everything in this material world is a relative thing. And as they say, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. For one person, it may appear very, very attractive, but for another person, it may appear very unpalatable. So the point here is not to get so enamored by whatever limited material facilities we have. We may have, you know, in our minds, a very attractive body, just like this Sankarshan, this Vidyadhara. He had what he considered to be a very, very attractive body. And he laughed at Angira Muni and his associates, and what happened to him? He got cursed to take the body of a snake. He said, because you're so sinful, you deserve to have the body of a snake. Snake bodies are actually considered to be a very sinful body. But he actually had a blessing that when he was touched by the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he would return to his original form. And actually we see he prays there to Lord Krishna that actually he's received the greatest fortune. And he talks about the glories of the holy name, etc. like that. But how, you know, he saw the Lord and he touched the Lord and he was able to chant the Lord's glories. So actually it was the greatest good fortune for him. So in here it talks about Upagiyamano. There's a verse Nivrittitasha Upagiyamano. It's in the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam, where it talks about the benefits of the glories of chanting the Lord's holy name. And actually, this is the supreme benefit for anyone. So even though he was cursed to take this form of a snake, of a giant serpent, still he got this opportunity to chant the Lord's name. And he talks about there how that this is actually the goal of one's life, is to be able to engage in discussing the topics of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, etc. And so it's interesting there that pastime finishes off with him. Actually, there's one a little bit after that I wanted to discuss, but basically the pastime finishes off with him discussing the glories of chanting the Lord's holy name. He says, anyone who chants your name purifies all who hears his chanting. Just understand that, we're so fortunate that we had, one thing is we had this rare human form of life. That's one of our fortunes to begin with. And then the next fortune we have is that somehow or other, by the inconceivable mercy of the Lord and the Vaishnavas, we've actually come into contact with this process of Krishna consciousness. This is not an ordinary thing. We need to understand it. Don't take your own self so seriously. Don't think how wonderful we are. I've got this facility, I've got that facility. Because actually, when you look at what we have, what do we have? We have nothing. We have nothing at all. Even though, we may think, oh, I've got a lot of money in the bank. You may have $10,000 in the bank, you may have $20,000, you may have $10 million, you may have $20 million. How much money has Bill Gates got in the bank? He's got a lot of money by our conception. But in comparison to someone like Kuvera, how much money has he got? Kuvera is the treasurer of the demigods. He's got unlimited wealth. But then even Kuvera, he has this unlimited wealth. What is it? It's insignificant in comparison to the wealth of Krishna. As Parashurama Muni explains, is Aishwarya Samagosha Viryasha Yashasha. That the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he fully possesses all wealth. Krishna explains this in the Gita. He says, Aham Savasha Pravo Mata Savam Pavatate Iti Matva Bhajante Mam Buddha Abha. That I am the source. He says, Aham Savasha Pravo. That I am the source. I'm the power that everything comes from. So therefore, being as he is the creator, he's the only creator actually. No one else can create. Being as he is the creator, he is also the proprietor. And he says this in the 5th chapter, Bhaktarang Yagatapasam, Sarvaloka Maheshwaram. That I am the Maheshwar, I am the proprietor of everything, the controller. We need to understand what is Krishna's position and what is our position. There's a gulf of difference. There's a wide gulf of difference, and an unlimited gulf of difference. So this is the beginning of humility, is to understand our actual position in this material world. We have nothing, absolutely nothing. Our body is temporary. How long does it last? We may think we're very beautiful. We may think we're very handsome. How long does that last? Even if you're so vain, you're so possessed by vanity, you go to the extent of plastic surgery to have things adjusted and tucked and tightened and lifted, and you get them to inject things into your face, in your lunch break and all this type of stuff. How long does it last? They have that here in Melbourne. You can ring these people up. You make an appointment in your lunch hour. You go in and you get all these injections. I remember maybe last year or the year before, I was out on doing a bit of fundraising, and I went into this, I think it was a hardware store or something like that, and there's the two ladies there, and one lady was making fun of the other lady because she just had this, I think they call it liposuction, where they do something to their lips. Anyhow, she looked like she'd been punched in the mouth. Yeah, her lips were like that, all like swollen up, and they were sort of swollen for a few days like that, and so the other lady was making fun of it. But this is just understand the vanity that people are motivated by. They're completely convinced that I am this body, therefore I'll do whatever I can to make the body more attractive. But understand, even though you may do these things, even though you may spend tens of thousands of dollars on plastic surgery and all these different types of things, how long does it last? How long is your body going to be beautiful? Maybe at the most 50 or 60 years. And then what? What will you do then? And you may have wealth. How long is that wealth going to last? You may be the richest person in the world. How long is the wealth going to last? You may want to... I remember when I was a child, we used to read Donald Duck cartoons. And there's one character in there called Scrooge McDuck. And I'm sure you've all heard of Scrooge McDuck. And he'd always be, you know, relishing counting his money and stuff like that. And he was always... Just see the things the mind hangs on to, huh? And there was these guys called the Beagle Boys, and they were the big bad guys, and they were always trying to steal his money. And he was always in complete anxiety. Every time he'd see the Beagle Boys, he'd just, you know, have an anxiety attack because he thought they were trying to steal his money. And that's what it's like in this world. People have money, and they're constantly in anxiety that someone's going to steal it. And oftentimes, somebody does steal it, or they lose it. Like, I think on Friday, I lost my wallet. So I'm always against, you know, always like not into having wallets, because you lose the wallet, you lose everything. It's the second wallet I've lost in my life. You know, so you get an anxiety about these things. It's disturbing. Because you're attached. You're attached to this material facility. You're attached to having a little bit of money or a piece of plastic. So you can go in a shop and they just swipe your piece of plastic and you buy something. I was actually listening to these lectures of Bhaktivedanta Purnamaraj. He was talking about how the Vaishyas function in Kali Yuga. And the Vaishya, the way they function is they try to agitate your senses so you buy things. Yeah? And they do it very well, you know, like with advertising, for instance. You know, like in the Vedic age, you wouldn't see advertising because the Kshatriyas would keep the Vaishyas under control. But now, the Vaishyas are given all facility for economic development, anything they want. And I was talking with Guru yesterday. Guru works in a debt collection agency. And he was telling me about the amount of debts. He was telling me every month, Origin Energy, just one company, gives them 1,000 to 1,500 new cases to, in 1 month. So, I mean, and the debt, I was also talking with Bharat last night, and he was telling me about the amount of debt that people are in. Now, the average credit card debt in Australia, for everyone who's got a credit card, the average credit card debt is $5,000. So everyone in Australia with a credit card is at least average $5,000 in debt. So this is because the Vaishyas are out of control. The government is not keeping them, and therefore they have to keep bumping up the credit rate, the interest rates, because so many people are getting in huge debt for housing and stuff like that. The Vaishyas are out of control. And what they're doing is they're just enticing people. It's like, yes, you can have this now. You know, it's just like you see the ads. They say, you want it? Get it now. Get yourself into debt up to your eyeballs. And what happens is because you see someone who's actually a Vaishya, they will never get in debt like that. No, rather they will save the money and they'll go out and buy it for cash. But someone who's a Sudra will get into debt. They'll think, oh yes, this is very good. I can have it now. I can enjoy it now. So they'll go out and get it. Yeah? So this is because the Kshatriyas, actually in Kali Yuga, we don't see anyone who's really manifesting the qualities of a Kshatriya. Yeah? I mean, there are plenty of angry people around who like fighting. But anger is a symptom of ignorance. The Kshatriyas are mostly influenced by passion. They may use anger sometimes. Yeah? But generally, they're not like angry. You know, you see angry young men storming around the place. You know, like someone kicked my wife's car door in the other day. You know, so this is probably some angry young man. You know, just want to take his frustrations. Or recently, there was on the news. I heard a few days ago in passing. I heard someone had taken a gun or some high power rifle and shot all these seals somewhere here in Victoria. I mean, what's the point? What'd they do that for? You can see that actually the society is out of control. There's no leader. You know? There's just some bureaucrat who has no leadership quality whatsoever. And you'll find that, you know, you look at any angle of government. It's interesting, I was listening because this lecture series that Bhaktivedanta Purnamaraj was talking about, it's talking about Vaishnav culture. And it's kind of interesting because the general perception we have, and I think it's basically it's a misperception, is that anyone who's engaged in fighting is a kshatriya. Anyone who's engaged in some sort of like, you know, academic pursuit is a brahmana. Anyone who's making money is a vaishya. And anyone who's doing hard labour is a sudra. So the sudra thing is kind of, yeah, you're doing hard labour, you're serving others, that's a sudra. But a vaishya, it's like if you have the experience, you go to India and you go into the shops and you'll see, you know, all these guys and they're really expert. You see them, the way they throw the cloth out for you and spread it across the floor, and they're very, you know, animated, etc. like that. So we have this perception that they're vaishyas, but actually no, they're not, because they're employed by the vaishya. The fellow who sits in the corner with a big fat belly chewing pan with a money box, that's the vaishya. He's the one who makes the money. He's the one who knows how to make money. And Prabhupada said, he told a story one time about this young man who, when he came of age, he went to see his uncle, and he was saying that, you know, okay, now I've come of age, I want to start a business, so can you please help me? Can you please give me a start in business? So he went out, he took him to the window and he pointed out the street and he said, see there that dead rat on the ground? He said, that is your start. So he took that dead rat, and he I think at that time there was a bounty on dead rats because there was some plague or something around. So he sold it, and from that he got the money, and he used the money to do something else and gradually built up a huge empire. And Prabhupada explains that a vaishya is one who, if the market is up, he makes money. If the market is down, he makes money. A vaishya is someone who will make money in any circumstance. Right? Not someone who's working in the shop or someone who's engaged in business. The person who's just throwing the cloth out, you know, if you look at, they're actually by nature sudras. Because they don't have this ability to make money. And you'll see the same right throughout all the varnas. You know, just like, for instance, you'll see with kshatriyas. Last week I was listening to the Mahabharata, and very interesting there, and it talks about how, you know, the when they were at the Battle of Kurukshetra, that sometimes Arjuna, he would fire these astras into the air, and the astra was such that, you know, the arrow or the weapon would divide into thousands and thousands and thousands of arrows and just start raining arrows down like rain. Just pointing out. And he would be killing thousands upon thousands upon thousands of men. Huh? So all the foot soldier types of the one, because the kshatriyas, they could counteract these astras with their own astras. Because they're the ones who are actually, you know, like very, you know, adept. You know, there'd be ratis and maharatis and ati ratis, like Arjuna, he was an ati rati, you know. And even what was his name? Abhimanyu. Atirat, very powerful warrior. You know, he actually fought with seven Maharatis, Bhishma and Karna and Drona and Duryodhana. They're all fighting with him. And he's just a young boy. And he took if you read the description, he took the chariot wheel into his hand. He picked up, because all his weapons were smashed, his chariot was smashed. So he got down, he picked up the chariot wheel, and he's spinning the chariot wheel. And as he was spinning the chariot wheel, they're firing weapons at him, and he's spinning in such a way that he's flicking their weapons back at them. This is a kshatriya. Huh? Not some guy with a bad temper who wants to beat up people that are smaller than him. That's the perception these days. You know, he goes around and hits on people. Oh, he's got kshatriya spirit. No, he's a coward. A kshatriya, when he's faced with an opponent who's stronger than him, doesn't run away. He likes that. That he gets more fired up. You know, there's like in the Battle of Kurukshetra, we see that there was these persons that had taken a vow that they would kill Arjuna on this day or they themselves would die fighting. And they knew that Arjuna was a greater personality than them, but for the prestige of being killed by Arjuna, for a kshatriya, you know, because they're very proud people. So that was very prestigious for them to die in such a way. And actually we understand, you know, Krishna explains that, you know, whoever died, who was killed at the hand of Arjuna, actually achieved the heavenly planets, because heavenly planets themselves actually achieve liberation, I think, because they died in front of Krishna. So it was a very, very wonderful opportunity for them. So we see that in modern times, not just here in the West, but everywhere in the world, there's these misperceptions of the different varnas. Yeah? They don't really understand what a kshatriya is, or a vaishya, or a sudra. Practically speaking, as it says, Kalor Sudra Sambhava, everyone is a sudra, born sudra in Kali Yuga. But brahmanas, kshatriyas and vaishyas very, very misunderstood what this is. So, I'm not sure how or why I got to that point. It's interesting. One point I was also looking at here is in the last verse of the previous pastime. It talks about the inhabitants of Braja were astonished to see the mighty power of Sri Krishna. And they completed their worship of Lord Shiva and returned to Braj. So Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur comments on this, how the residents of Vrindavan were sort of discussing among themselves, is, can this boy, he says here, can this boy whom we fondle with affection and who cannot be peaceful for a moment without us, Krishna's perfectly taking up the role of a young boy. And when you see that, young boys are so, just like you watch Aditya or one of these other young boys when they're around the place, they're just like constantly, like even when you're upstairs taking prasadam, Aditya's running here, he's running there, you can't sit still for a minute. Children are like that, the young children, they're like that. They can't sit still for a minute. It's only when their parents, get them to sit down and they entertain them that they can sit still. So Krishna's perfectly taken up this role. And he says, can he be the Supreme Lord? And they start to wonder, because they're seeing he just comes and touches this serpent. And wow, he manifests as his Vidyadhara. And the Vidyadhara starts to offer all these beautiful prayers to Krishna, praising him as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So they're quite astounded. And then they say, if that is so, then all of us, mothers and fathers, are also great personalities. They're understanding, to some extent, their position. And then they start to marvel upon their own good fortune, that they have this connection with Krishna. So this struck me, because I was thinking that in our situation, you look at, basically where we have all come from. And I think we could say that without a doubt, that every one of us has come from a very, very degraded situation. I mean, just being in this material world is a degraded situation. There's an interesting verse in the 10th canto, I think it's the 12th or the 14th, no, 14th chapter, where Lord Brahma has been, corrected by Krishna when he sees, all the calves and the cowherd boys manifesting as four-armed Vishnu forms. And then so he's praying to the Lord, and he says, my dear Lord, he says, this concept of auspicious and inauspicious in the material world is simply a mental speculation, because actually everything in the material world is inauspicious. So this is what we've come from. We've all come from a very, very inauspicious situation. I mean, just look at the material body. How auspicious is the material body? You're forced. Birth, death, old age and disease. You're forced. It's not like you choose. It's not like you can go and say, well, I don't want to get sick this month. You don't have any choice in it. Miseries are forced upon us. So it's a very, very inauspicious situation. And actually, excuse me, we have no good qualities. We have no piety, actually. If you look at a country like Australia, how much piety is there in a country like Australia? There was this song out years ago before I joined ISKCON, and it was some Australian band, and they were singing football, meat pies, kangaroos and Holden cars. It's like the Australian national anthem, Oh, there's actually one song written by Vaishnav, which is a nice song. He says, give me a home among the gum trees with lots of plum trees, a sheep or two and a kangaroo. And I know this song because he's a devotee, isn't he? Buckley actually knows him, he knew him quite well. So these are like national anthems of Australia. It's all, Australian life is all about this, Football, meat pie, kangaroo, Holden car, Foster's lager, whatever it is, name your poison, they used to say. Australian life is all about this, It's such a glorious thing, We have this wonderful opportunity, we've achieved this rare human form of life. And what do? We waste it on such a inane, low-class culture, which is actually the culture of animals. My wife and myself were sitting out in the courtyard at our apartment the other day, because when the sun shines, it's actually very nice to sit out there and take prasad. And these people are just a few flats down. They had some visitors. G'day, mate, how you going? They start swearing. I mean, every second word was swear this, swear that. It's like, oh, my God, And it's just like, they just sound like dogs barking at each other. I mean, of course, we don't want to, cast any aspersions on anyone or criticise anyone. Yet we see they have this, as Prahlad Maharaj says, is Dulabham Madhusam Janma, this rare human form of life, this rare human birth. You know, there is unlimited living entities. Unlimited. You cannot count how many living entities there are on this planet. And it's rare that one actually gets to take the human birth. So when we have this human birth, use it wisely. You know, in the very first verse of the Vedanta Sutra says, Atato Brahma Gigyasa. Now that you've achieved this human form of life, use it for inquiry into the nature of Brahman. This is what human life is for. It's not for living, as it says in the second canto of the Bhagavatam. It compares all human beings to hogs, dogs, camels and asses. And Prabhupada, it's a wonderful purport. Prabhupada just goes out and explaining how people are just like hogs, dogs, camels and asses. And it's quite an extraordinary. He talks about the hogs, you know, because people will eat anything. And you see that, you know, you can see people that eat snails. I remember long time before I joined DISCOM, these people at work tried to play a trick on me. This girl had been to France and she brought back this box of chocolates, and she wanted me to eat one of these chocolates. And it turned out, I didn't want it, you know, because I just knew what she was like and I thought she was playing a trick. It turned out to be a chocolate coated grasshopper. Apparently it's a delicacy. They like to eat snails. I mean, I remember when I was in China years ago, and the things you see in the marketplace there are just unbelievable, that people would even imagine to eat these things. So that's like they're hogs, they'll eat anything. Dogs. Prabhupada gives an interesting analogy there. He says it's just like, you know, people, they go to university and they get an education and they get a degree, and then they go begging from door to door to door, trying to please give me some employment. Just like dogs, Prabhupada says, and they slam the door in their face. Just like the dog, he's coming from one person to the next begging for some food. And he gets the door slammed in his face. And camels, he uses a really interesting analogy with camel. It's just because the camel is very fond of chewing on this particular tree that has thorns. And when it chews, it's got very small leaves, big thorns. I don't know what the tree's called, but you see them in India. Big. Babul tree, huh? Prabhuji knows. So they have big thorns, and when they chew these leaves with the thorns on, what happens is their lips and their tongue become cut by the thorns, and so their mouth is bleeding, and the blood is mixing with the leaves that they're chewing, and they think, oh, this is such a nice taste. They're enjoying this taste, and Prabhupada says this is like sex life. That they engage in sex life. Repeatedly, they're engaging in sex life and they think, oh, this is so nice. But he describes actually they're just using up their own blood. And then the ass. And Prabhupada gives a few different descriptions of the ass, just like you see anyone who's been to India, you don't see so much washermen using asses these days, but you see the people who bring building supplies to building sites. They load them up so much with bricks or so much with sand that if they put another brick or another cup full of sand on the ass's back, it would break his legs. They're just so loaded up. And what happens is they're working like this hard day and night. And what happens is the master gives them some grass. And you see that. They actually give them a handful of grass, you know. Like, you know, a big handful of grass like that. And the thing is, it's so easily available. It's right there on the side of the road. They can get this easily. And then he also says that the ass, and you hear them, is they're so fond of singing. And anyone who's heard an ass sing, it's quite a monotonous sort of monotone type thing. But they like the sound of their own voice. And also, one thing, because Prabhupada describes this, and a few years ago when I was in India, I actually took some photos of this. I thought, it's real, it happens, you know. Because that's the thing, it's like when you go to Vrindavan particularly, it's obvious that Prabhupada got a lot of his, the analogies he uses in the Bhagavatam, he actually must have picked a lot of these up in Vrindavan, because he talks about how the ass, when he approaches the she-ass, what does she do? Kicks him in the face. Bam! Both feet. I saw it. Like, my God, look at that. And again he goes up and she goes, bam! Both feet right in the face like that. And he's bleeding from the face. And you see, you look at the he-asses, and they've all got like these like moon-shaped marks on their faces where the she-ass has kicked him. So he compares this to, like, you know, the materialistic person. You know, he's approaching his wife and she's causing him so much grief, yet still he's, you know, So it's like that. And so we see that in this material world, we don't really have a lot to offer. We don't really have a lot going for us. We're actually deeply entangled in a network of material desires, which brings us so much misery. And we see, just like, you know, the hogs, the dogs, the camels, the asses, they're all out there trying to enjoy themselves, and ultimately it just brings them misery. And we have all been in the same situation. Yet somehow or other, by the mercy of the Lord, as what's that verse? Talks about Brahmanda Brahmati Kona Bhagavana Jeev Guru Krishna Prasad Kripa Poi Bhakti Lata Beej. It's talking about how the living entity in this material world, he's wandering throughout the universe, up and down. Brahmanda means like the universe. You know, under means like an egg. You know? So he's wandering up and down in the universe. Brahmati Kona Bhagavan, Bhagyavana Jeeva. Bhagyavan means very fortunate. Jeeva, that living entity, very fortunate. One who's very fortunate, he actually receives the mercy of Krishna. So we understand this, it's not by our own endeavors that we've come to this Krishna consciousness movement. And he says, by the mercy of Krishna, one receives the spiritual master. This has all come about by the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And then, by the mercy of the spiritual master, one actually receives Krishna. So, somehow or other, one who's, you know, we've become fortunate. We don't understand how we've become fortunate. And we see that, like, just like in the end of the Gita, Arjuna, he talks to Krishna. You know, like, Krishna's just gone through the whole instruction of the Bhagavad Gita. He says, now have you understood? And what does Arjuna say? He doesn't say that, yes, by my intelligence I've understood your instructions. And he was an intelligent person, there's no doubt. But he doesn't say that to Krishna. Yes, because I'm so intelligent I understood everything you said. Because I've got an Oxford degree or whatever, I understood everything you said. Or because I'm a PhD in some IT subject, I understood everything. No. He said, Tat prasada maya chuta. By your mercy, O Achuta. Achuta means infallible one. By your mercy I have understood. And, what does he say? Karishe vachanam tava. So tava means words. Karishe, do. Karishe vachanam tava. That I will do. Sorry, vachanam's word and karishe. I will act according to your words. Tava is your. So by your mercy I've understood everything, and now I'll act according to your words. So the same is there for us. By Krishna's mercy, we have come into contact with the process of Krishna consciousness. Somehow or other, we've received this good fortune. And now that we have this good fortune, let's not waste it in useless activities. Let's not waste it in activities that are just going to cause us to become bound up further and further in this material world. Because just because we've come into contact with Krishna consciousness doesn't mean guaranteed that I'm going to become a pure devotee in a couple of months' time and go back home to God at the end of this life. It's not that simple. It requires a lot of hard work. Very hard work. But don't despair, because it's not as hard as the hard work the materialists have to go through to get there, to satisfy their goals. There's not, you know, there's so much suffering they have to go through, etc. No, it's definitely hard work to make progress in Krishna consciousness. We have to apply ourselves very diligently to the process. And, you know, keep our eyes trained to spot different anarthas as they come up, to weed them out. Keep our eyes trained to make sure we don't deviate from the process. There's so many subtle and gross and, you know, different types of problems that come up for us. So we need to be very, very vigilant, constantly, you know, keeping the mind in check. Just like we were discussing before about the Vaishyas, how in Kali Yuga they're completely out of check. And the government, rather than keeping them in check, gives them all facility. They even change the laws to make it easier for the Vaishyas to make money. They don't do anything to stop how much in debt people get. There's no law saying that you can only be so much in debt. Every year the bank sends me I've got a credit card. I had a credit card. It's gone now in my wallet. But I've got this credit card. Every year the bank sends me a letter saying, "Oh, we'll increase your limit." You know, they've increased my limit to more money than I can earn in 3 years. And they'd happily let me get that much in debt. Happily. Because what happens is you get in debt, they outsource the thing to somebody else. You know, they outsource the debt collection to somebody else. So, you know, they don't mind. They're making money out of it. And that's all it's about. They don't really care what it does to your quality of life as long as they're making money from you. And they'll have, you know, you hear stories, you know, of they're giving credit cards to children. You know? 13, 14, 15-year-old children have got credit cards. Well, they've got phones. They've got, you know, you hear these stories of kids who have clocked up $2,000 in phone bills. People just give it to them. The companies just give it. They just go and they play. You got some identification? Yeah, okay, there's your phone. They'll give them a contract. And because it's a contract, they're signed on the dotted line, it means that someone's liable to pay that money. It usually winds up being the parents. So the vices have become very, very unscrupulous. So the mind is like that. The mind is like an unscrupulous vaisya. We'll do anything just to try and engage the senses, just to enjoy. And you see, just like, you know, a living entity has the body of a ghost, there's nothing they won't do to try to enjoy themselves. And they inhabit somebody else's body and exploit their senses. And this is what happens. And for them, it's no loss. Because they're yours. They're somebody else's senses, they're not mine. And you see that sometimes. You see people who are like, you know, habitual drinkers or habitual, you know, drug takers and stuff like that. Generally, they're affected by ghosts. Not always, but you know, generally you find they're affected by ghosts. So we see that the mind is very, very... there's a verse in the 6th chapter of the Gita, Asang Yatmano Yoga Dushpapa Itimima here, where it talks about how when the mind is engaged in... it's in the purport where Prabhupada talks about how the mind, when it's engaged in Krishna's service, is the best friend. But when the mind is not engaged in Krishna's service, then it's the greatest enemy. So we need to understand this and see how the mind functions and how the mind becomes affected. So the process of Krishna consciousness is very nice because it gives us this opportunity to engage completely in Krishna's service, our mind, body, intelligence, words, everything. And as it points out, Rupa Goswami, he points out, Iha yasya hare dasya kamana manasikara nikalas vaptajasta so jivan mukta suchite. One who acts to serve Krishna with his mind, body, intelligence and words is understood to be liberated, even though he's within a material body performing so many so-called material activities. Because he's acting with mind, body, intelligence and words to serve Krishna, this person is understood to be liberated. Yeah? It's only time separating, as Prabhupada would say. And so by acting in this way, by using mind, body, intelligence, words to serve Krishna, then we actually achieve liberation. So I'll just read this translation here. Krishna and Balaram wore flower garlands and spotless garments, and their limbs were beautifully decorated and anointed. The women sang their glories in a charming way, bound to them by affection. So we see here, this is a beautiful description of Krishna and Balaram, how they, you know, and it's describing what they're like. They're wearing flower garlands and spotless garments. Yeah? Not a mark on their garments. And their limbs are beautifully anointed. And it mentions here in the transliteration, it says, with sandalwood pulp. But we see that Krishna's described how, there's actually a really nice verse in the first canto when Bhishma Dev is describing Krishna. He talks about how his limbs are beautifully decorated. There's all these different designs drawn on his limbs with sandalwood paste and his feet. Actually, Bhishma Dev says his whole body is decorated with tulsi. We see that Krishna is always beautifully decorated. And I was listening to this lecture the other day and it was talking about this culture that we follow in ISKCON. You know, the type of food we eat, the way we see Krishna is dressed, you know, he's always wearing a garland, things like this. And this is actually Vrindavan culture. And we see something that we have something this culture, though I don't know if I would call it culture. There's a joke you may have heard. What's the difference between a cup of yogurt and an Australian? Yeah, yogurt has culture. Yeah. So generally Australians are considered to be fairly cultureless people. And we see, you know, if you just, you know, have any interactions with people out in the workforce, then you'll, you know, I often talk to devotees who are working in the various offices and stuff, and they, you know, like Kripa Sindhu was telling me the other day, he finds it very hard to work with the people at work because they're very cultureless people. And here in ISKCON, we're trying to develop culture, actually, but not some artificial culture, but real culture. And the culture that Srila Prabhupada and our acharyas have presented to us, we need to understand the importance of this culture and how elevated this culture is. This is culture because what Krishna himself likes. He has chosen, I mean, you know, he could have chosen anything he wanted to do. You know, he could have chosen to behave like an Australian. You know, if he thought that was the highest, he would have done that. And, you know, you would have seen him in a pair of shorts and a tank top and etc. like that. You know, like, although you don't see that so much these days. I remember when I grew up, that was quite, you know, blue tank top, black shorts, you know, the terry towel hat and the beer. That was like, you know, that was stereotypical type of it. That was an Australian, you know, that's what they, you know, at the tennis. Yeah? You don't see that so much these days. But, you know, I mean, if Krishna thought that was the highest, he would have, and the way Australians speak, or, you know, not so much these days, but strine, you know, this is a language strine, you know, that was, when I was growing up, that was quite common. So, you know, that was a culture, so to speak. Yet Krishna didn't choose anything like that. Krishna chose, you know, the culture you see that our acharyas have given us in ISKCON. And it's not like it's just an arbitrary thing. It's not just that it's unimportant. This is actually the highest culture because this is what Krishna likes. I mean, it's okay if you like something else. That's all right. That's not a problem. But don't think it's the highest. You know, if you like a particular type of diet, you know, maybe your body has some issues that need to be dealt with by diet or whatever, that's okay. Or maybe you like a particular type of food. Maybe you like eating pizza and pasta. That's okay. But don't think that this is higher than the culture that Krishna has given. Because if it's what Krishna likes, it means it's the highest. So the diet of sabji rice, dal, chapatis, this is the highest. Or the dress we wear. This is what, you know, we see Krishna is wearing spotless garments, dhoti. Him and Balaram is described as wearing dhoti. He wears a golden coloured dhoti. Balaram wears a blue coloured dhoti. And they dress themselves, they ornament their bodies with sandalwood, and sometimes they use the ochres and different things from the ground to ornament their body and make their bodies appear very beautiful. Huh? No, I was walking down the street the other day, yesterday I think, and I saw this guy, he had one thing through his nose and one thing through his eye and one, you know, all these things in his ears and stuff, thinking it's very beautiful. And to my vision, it's horrific. It's just, he's disfiguring the body. You know, people like actors and things, disfiguring the body. Some young men, they get like these bizarre or obscene things tattooed on their bodies. And I remember some of the devotees in the early days had them, you know, and they'd actually get them laser thing to get rid of them, you know. I remember Sadhbush had that, right? I remember it left that really big scar on his arm. You know, because later on they get these things done with their young men, they disfigure the body, and then later on they're embarrassed by it. So they're always wearing like long sleeve shirts to cover it up and stuff like that. And so these things, we don't see that Krishna, you know, there's no mention of Krishna having a tattoo. There's no mention of Krishna having, you know, like things through his eyebrows or through his nose, you know, a bone through his nose or anything like that. There's no mention of it. This Vedic culture is actually the highest culture. And the thing is about this culture is designed to help us think of Krishna. Everything is designed to help us think of Krishna. This is the goal of life, is to actually become absorbed in Krishna consciousness. So our acharyas have given us this lifestyle, it's like we're reading here about the way they're dressed, you know, to help us, you know, we dress like this. This is a Vaishnava way of dressing, because we see with the materialists, the way they dress is to draw their attention to each other's bodies. You know, and now it's starting to warm up, you're going to become more and more aware of that. Yeah, especially if we live so close to the beach here, you become more and more aware of it. Yeah. So, you know, the whole thing is just to draw attention, particularly to the lower, you know, the lower parts of the body. They're dressed in such a way. Yeah. And the whole society, the whole materialistic society, is simply aimed at increasing sense, increasing our entanglement in this material world. Yet the Vedic society, the structure of the Vedic society, is simply aimed at one purpose: surrender to Krishna. So it is the highest culture. There is no highest culture because there is no higher goal of life. What do they call it? Prema Pumarto Mahan. That this This is the highest thing. This is the love of Godhead. There is nothing higher. And the culture that we've been given is simply for this purpose, is to bring us to this purpose of loving Krishna. Yeah? So, in whatever way we can, we try to take up this culture. And, you know, the way we dress, the way we speak with each other, the way we, you know, interact with each other, the way we eat, everything. It's a whole lifestyle. It's not just, you know, an imposition. The Prabhupada would say it's not an artificial imposition. It is actually, you know, the culture of the world. So, and it's nice, you know, the way these descriptions are here, talking about how praised the glories are being sung. You know, charmingly, it says, Upigiyamano lalitam. Their glories are being sung in a charming way. As the women sang their glories in a charming way, bound to them by affection. And this is a really important point. This bound by affection. That all the relationships, you know, in the spiritual world, every single relationship, Maharaj was touching on this other day, every single relationship is through affection. You know? Whereas you see here, in like materialistic society, the relationships are centered around money. You know? Someone goes and does something for someone else. Why? Because they pay me. As soon as they stop paying me, I don't work for them anymore. There's no real relationship. It's just business. And that's part of the essence. Nisringadeva was offering Prahlad Maharaj a benediction. He said, "My dear Lord, I think this is simply business. I don't worship you because I want to get something in return. I worship you because I love you." And this is the thing, is like all our relationships, we need to work on, you know, developing affection in our relationships, and appropriate affection, you know, appropriate interaction. It's not that we just, you know, like the type of relationship one may have with their wife, you're not going to have with your mother or your sister or your daughter. That's just inappropriate. This is what is called rasabhas. So the affection needs to be appropriate to the relationship also, but it's a very important part of the culture. If you see the way that the residents of Vrindavan interact with each other, and you know, particularly in the previous chapters, also in these chapters here, we see the way the residents of Vrindavan interact with each other. It's all due to affection. There's so much love there. We need to learn how to develop loving relationships amongst ourselves, because this is the ultimate conclusion, is to develop a loving relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Yet, if we can't have loving relationships with devotees, what chance is there of having a loving relationship with Krishna? If you can't do it here, you're not going to do it there in the spiritual world. Right? It's not like... I used to be, years ago, I was a recording engineer, worked in a recording studio, and there used to be this saying amongst many, what we consider to be lesser quality engineers, fix it in the mix. You know, it means like there was some problem with what was being recorded. Oh, don't worry about it, we'll fix it in the mix. But the understanding we had that if you didn't have that sound you're looking for there on tape, you would never be able to achieve it. So saying, if you cannot develop a loving relationship here and now with the devotees, those who are dear to Krishna, then we're not going to achieve that loving relationship with Krishna. So here we're in this very nice situation, is we have this opportunity to associate with so many nice devotees and develop loving relationships with these devotees. And to serve them. Not to be the master, but to serve. This is a very important thing, is to serve devotees and develop loving relationships. And through this mutual service and mutual loving relationships, this will help us to become purified and overcome our anarthas and eventually progress back to the spiritual world. It's a wonderful process, and if we take shelter of it fully, we will achieve the fruit. And it is the nicest fruit. There's no fruit nicer than the fruit of Krishna. Okay, thank you very much for patiently listening. Are there any questions at all?
I have two comments about what you said. About the cards, they are having a scandal now about the cards. As you're saying, they didn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
Now they are having a scandal. They are, say, somebody is a party leader at this month. Somebody bought something in Sydney on his car, and his trip was sent 160 kilometers away. And they took out all the money from their limit, and the poor person could not buy anything in Sydney.
Mm.
So they are saying that they have to pass, so that there will be no scandal, because Australia is the target now for having this scandal of the cards.
Yeah. But that's the thing, it's like these things are just designed to cause you misery. And unscrupulous people.